Great. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the McKinley Oration. This oration coincides with the 5th Annual Otago International Health Research Network Conference that's taking place today and tomorrow at the Hunter Centre. This oration's named for the McKinley family, who endow a chair at the Centre for International Health, and we gratefully acknowledge their contribution to global health activities at the university. The McKinley Oration will be delivered by Professor Stephen Luby. Steve's a Professor of Medicine with the Division of Infectious Diseases, Deputy Director for Research at the Centre for Global Health Innovation, a Senior Fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, and a Senior Fellow at the Woods Institute at Stanford University. After studying philosophy at Creighton University, Steve earned his medical degree from the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School at Dallas in 1986 and completed his internship and residency in internal medicine at the University of Rochester Strong Memorial Hospital. He went on to study epidemiology and public health with the Epidemic Intelligence Service and the Preventive Medicine Residency of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. With assignments at the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control and the CDC Malaria Branch in Atlanta. From 1993 to 1998, Dr. Luby directed the Epidemiology Unit at the Community Health Sciences Department at the Aga Khan University in Karachi, Pakistan. And in 1998 to 2004, he returned to Atlanta to work as a medical epidemiologist in the Foodborne and Diarrheal Diseases branch at the CDC on causes and prevention of diarrheal disease in settings where diarrhea is a leading cause of childhood death. For the past 8 years, Steve was seconded from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to the International Center for Diarrheal Diseases Research, Bangladesh, or ICDDRB, where he directed the Center for Communicable Diseases and served as the country director for CDC Bangladesh. Dr. Luby's recently returned to the US to a position at Stanford University. His research focuses on public health, water, sanitation, and communicable disease. And as I've mentioned, much of Steve's career has been spent in developing countries where these diseases have the highest impact. On a personal note, I've known Steve for the last 12 years. And I know him as an outstanding scientist, deeply committed to engaging and developing trainees to understand and address the most pressing public health problems faced by the poor around the world. So I'm delighted that Steve's travelled to Dunedin to be with us this week. He's had a packed program since arriving yesterday morning. And let's join and warmly welcome Steve to speak on global water shortages and health agenda for the coming decades.
Well, John, thank you very much for that introduction. And I am so grateful to the Otago community and to all of the warmth and hospitality I've received here. I think what I will take away as one of my key moments in terms of understanding New Zealand was I was a little groggy after the 12-hour flight and stumbled off the plane. And then getting ready to go through security, I realized I didn't have my Nook tablet with me, that I'd left it on the plane. I know what would have happened had I left the Nook tablet on the plane in Bangladesh or in Pakistan, where I've lived. So I had a chance to test this in the new system. And I'm happy to say that people were very quick, and they have assured me that they have a number on it, and on my way out, I will be reunited with my tablet. So I'm very impressed, and as I say, grateful. I want to talk today about water and health. And water is something we all need to survive. And even when water gets short, we still have a need for a certain amount of water to just get along. And this is a problem because there are more and more of us just trying to get along. If we look at global population projections, how many people are living in the world now? I mean, we're undergoing a time of exponential growth, exponential demands on the environment, exponential demands on the water supply. And so even in the 50 years from 2000 to mid-century, we're projected to be adding another 2.5 billion people to the planet, with real questions about the planet carrying capacity. And we can feel this environmental issue very much around water. It's also important to note that most of the growth in population is projected to come from low-income countries. So countries that don't have the maximum amount of resources either to mitigate health or environmental consequences of such growth. So when we consider this through the lens of demands on water, we often think about, well, how much water are we using in the bathroom? Or if we're a parent of adolescent daughters, we think about how much water is being used in the shower. And a typical person, depending on where they live, will consume 30 to 300 liters per day for water from domestic use. But it's really agriculture that is the major consumer of water globally. Just to keep any of us alive for a day, that's typically 3,000 liters of water that went into processing the food that we eat for one day. So when we look over the planet about human freshwater consumption, 70% of all of the fresh water that's used for human use is used for agriculture. And if we think about groundwater that's being drawn out and being depleted, 93% of groundwater abstraction is being used for agriculture. So if we have a growing population, a population we not only have to continue to feed everybody here, but even more people going forward, this means there is an increased demand for food. And if we're going to need, and if we need to grow more food, then there is an increased demand for water. There is one particular aspect of raising food that is water intense. And this is not some extremist publication that I'm referring to. This is the UN's Food and Agricultural Association's assessment, which they named Livestock's Long Shadow. And they particularly emphasize the heavy use, the heavy demands that livestock put on global water supply. 8% of total human water use is used for raising livestock that people eat. And if you measured, if you also accounted for all the evaporative loss that occurs across pasture, across cropland, maybe even as much as 30%. Of water goes into raising livestock. And in raising livestock, it's not just the water it consumes in terms of its impact on water ecology. It also accounts for 55% of the erosion. And these are figures from the U.S. on water pollution, 33% of nitrogen and phosphorus, 37% of pesticides, 30% of heavy metals, and 50% of antibiotics. So when we think about the demands of feeding a growing population in terms of its impact on water, we know that livestock is a particularly important demand. This is somewhat concerning because meat consumption is growing at even a faster rate than is population growth. As economies and middle incomes grow, there is an increased demand for livestock, and with it, an increased demand for water. So between 1995 and 2025, livestock water demand is projected to increase 71% globally. And you look at where those increases are, once again, it's in the low-income countries. That we're seeing the low income and growing East Asian countries that were low income at this point that are really pushing up global demands for meat. And remember, this is not just more calories, but even again, higher demands for water. So when I was in grade school, I was taught about a water cycle. So where is the water going to come from? And we were even taught songs about the water cycle, where they said, you know, this is all a natural process, whereby water rains down, we get runoff, we can use some of that surface water, some of it goes down into an aquifer, we might pump that up. That the crops then give off water, goes back into the clouds, and we have this cycle that goes on and on. And what we do then is we live in balance with that cycle. But this is an example of pivot irrigation in Saudi Arabia. So they're growing crops. Now, where is that water coming from? Water is coming from an aquifer deep underground. That aquifer was filled millennia ago, thousands if not millions of years ago. The aquifer is not being replenished. There is no water cycle here, at least along any of the kinds of timelines that we would think about. So you may be able to grow crops like this for a while in Saudi Arabia, but just like you run out of oil, you run out of water, and that's not getting filled up again. And so when we take a look at this idea of aquifers as being a particularly important source for the Green Revolution, it has really been groundwater-driven irrigation that has allowed us to feed this growing population. And then you say, well, what's happening to the aquifers? What's happening to our water bank to continue to be able to feed? It's pretty concerning when we look across North Africa and we see so many countries depending for their entire fresh water supply on non-replenishing fossilized aquifers, as well as many other countries, even if there's some replenishment of aquifers, if you're drawing it out faster than it's going in, then this is non-sustainable. And we're seeing rapidly decreasing aquifers across some very major population centers. It's been estimated that up to 10% of the global annual water consumption is really coming from depleting groundwater. So we are basically eating into our seed bank. We're eating at a time when we are facing an ever-expanding population. So Lester Brown describes it by saying, in the Arab Middle East, the world is seeing the first collision between population growth and water supply at the regional level, that every day brings 10,000 more people to feed and less irrigation water with which to feed them. So projected across the globe, you need about 1,500 cubic meters of water per capita in order to meet basic needs, including agricultural needs. Below that, then cereal imports from other places that have water become crucial. Right now, 1.7 billion people live in basins with water scarcity already below 1,000 meters cubed. And again, I'm struck by the countries where this is projected to get even worse are places of major population growth. And of course, this is not just a developing country problem, some problem that's just somewhere else. Even if we think of water-rich New Zealand looking at how water rights are being given away or being sold and allocated, there are in fact many parts of the country that have all surface water either being fully allocated or over-allocated. This from the New Zealand Business Council, and is actually part included in the National Infrastructure Plan as well, showing that there is such a demand, primarily driven by agricultural demand, more and more demand on surface water to try to meet the economic needs for raising animals, taking them all to market. So, inevitably, as population grows with a fixed supply, what does this mean in the coming decades? It means that per capita water availability will decrease. We will have less water per person in 10 years than we have now. And we're already allocating so much of our water, and water supplies are decreasing. In addition, there are also factors decreasing the total supply. I've talked about groundwater and the fact that we are depleting aquifers, but we also have to deal with a warming climate. And we are seeing this both in terms of changes in temperature, in sea level, as was mentioned in some of the earlier talks today. And I want to mention particularly the issue of snowmelt, that glaciers in mountainous areas hold water that can predictably come down and refill and provide irrigation and fresh water. As temperatures rise, these glaciers disappear, and we lose some of the predictability of that water supply. The glacial-fed rivers of the Tibetan Plateau, for example, go to 40% of the world's population. And certainly projections about global warming have wide confidence limits. But in the coming decades, certainly by end century, these glaciers are predicted to disappear. And in consequence, even if we don't get to the point where they're disappearing, countries are already making decisions. So the Indians are building dams and diverting rivers, so less water comes into Bangladesh because of eventual concerns about what will be happening with global warming. So when there is a water shortage, this isn't just a geophysical phenomenon. This has very real consequences in terms of human health. We get food shortages. And I want to underline here particularly that if we are spending a lot of our money and our water to grow cattle, then we have less water, or for biofuels, then we have less water to grow basic grains and lentils and pulses for a needy human population. In addition, this kind of threat to human communities can result in considerable political disruption. With biofuels and with a poor, with some crop failures, in 2008 there was a spike in food prices. And here you can see the number of riots that occurred in various places, coincident with the increase in the price of grain. So this is not necessarily going to be a peaceful transition as we're trying to get by on less and less water per capita. And using a pure market solution, particularly if it means less grain for people, also risks political instability. There's much discussion within the water and health community about the relative importance of water quantity versus water quality. And I'm not, and I think the concerns with water quantity are very clear. If we don't have enough water, we can't grow enough food. If we can't grow enough food, we also don't have enough water for hygiene and other needs. But there's also an additional problem of water quality. In low-income communities throughout the world, water tends to be incompletely networked. Water is not running 24 hours a day. Indeed, across all of India, there are only two cities that have water running 24/7. So in a setting where more and more people are trying to make a living and they move in to the mega cities, there's a huge demand because that's where the jobs are. But remember, the aquifers are falling. So they actually have less supply and more people moving in. Demand far exceeds supply, and so as a consequence, they tend to run out water for a couple hours a day. And if you're in a community that is not networked at all, well, you wait for a water truck that comes through, and then you get a little water that way. I want to take us down to the perspective of being a pipe in the middle of the water. So if you're a pipe in Dunedin, the water's running 24/7. The water's always on, and so there's pressure in that pipe. Now, might there be a break in the pipe? Is it possible that there could be leaks in the pipe, even in wealthy and comfortable Dunedin? Well, it turns out these are European data. If you look at how much water you put into the system versus how much measure coming out in the meter, you have a median of 25% of the water that you put in that you lose before it comes out on the other end. So I don't think there's so, and that's in a European context. So I would argue that leaks are inevitable. Leaks are going to happen. So in Dunedin, you do have leaks, but water's on all of the time, so you lose water. It's inefficient, but the water within the pipe, because it's at high pressure, is probably going to be okay. When you turn the water off, like they do in India, it's a different situation. There's actually now no pressure in the pipe. The pipe is at low pressure. So the materials surrounding the pipe are going to leak in. And let's think about the kinds of materials that are going to be surrounding those pipes in highly densely populated urban settlements. Oh, that don't have water sewage treatment, may not even have flush toilets. So you've got a lot of human sewage in the community surrounding these pipes that are broken and spend most of their time at negative pressure sucking in the surrounding material. I tie this directly to, we have low supply, so we're going to have contamination. Now, once you get contamination in the pipe, this creates a problem. If you've got human sewage in the pipe, that then means that when people go to drink water, they're also drinking human sewage. And even if you want to say, we better put a lot of chlorine in, we better put something in, okay, it's a good idea, but it's so unpredictable what's going to be in there, how much, how many breaks there are going to be, all of the carbon load, you can't possibly do what you can do in Dunedin, which is figure out about how much chlorine you need, and it'll work throughout the network system. So an intermittent water supply is inevitable when you have a shortage of water. And an intermittent water supply also means contaminated water. So why does water quality matter? Why are we even talking about it? It's actually not a good idea to drink human sewage. This is not good for child growth. It's not good for development. Children who drink breast milk and water in low-income countries have twice the mortality of children who drink breast milk alone. There's a lot of contaminants in these water. In addition, it's not just the contamination, but remember, if you're short of water, then you're also going to have trouble growing crops. So a water shortage not only gives you contaminated water, it also means that maybe you're not getting optimal food into these children. And then the children get into what is really a vicious cycle where they do get infected from diarrheal disease. And with the infection, they have worsening appetite, impaired nutrient absorption. Because they're sick, they actually have increased metabolic requirements. They need to fight off this infection. But their whole body doesn't work as well, and they actually end up losing more nutrients. So the infection actually leads to malnutrition. But then the malnutrition predisposes the children to more infection as well. A malnourished child is much less able to repel such infections. So So a lack of water puts these vulnerable children in a vicious cycle at higher risk. So when we step back and look at globally, what are the causes of death of the 8 million children who die? Diarrhea turns out to be a big contributor. Somewhere between 1.3, 1.5 million children a year die from diarrhea. And a lot of this comes from organisms that are transmitted through water. In addition, here in the light green, you can see the proportion of all of the deaths that are also being contributed to by underweight. So the issues of both malnutrition and bacterial and viral contamination of water contribute very importantly to child death globally. And there are other waterborne infectious diseases. You might not know that Dr. Crump, in some of his earlier work, estimated that there are 200,000 deaths a year from typhoid fever. Typhoid fever is a disease that is basically spread by these intermittent municipal water supplies in large countries throughout South and Southeast Asia. There are parasitic infections and difficulties with environmental absorption, with absorption of nutrients because of environmental enteropathy. So a lot of waterborne infectious disease from poor water quality. Unfortunately, the compromise to water quality is not only infectious, but there are other contaminants as well. One of the concerns that we have a lot in Bangladesh is with arsenic. And arsenic is a geological contaminant. It's not an industrial contaminant, but it's a chemical contaminant in the water. And long-term exposure to arsenic, you can get lesions on the skin, lesions on the hand. But arsenic just causes a lot of bad problems. Children are born prematurely. Children are more likely to die in the neonatal state. You get impaired immunity. Children exposed to arsenic don't have the same intellectual development as children who have healthier water. Adults get high blood pressure, have more cardiovascular disease, more diabetes, and more cancer. So you're trying to drink water. People are drinking water because it's available, but this water can also be contaminated with chemicals. If we look at the United Nations effort to improve water, and there's a Millennium Development Goal 7, says we want to have by 2015 the proportion of people without sustainable access to safe drinking water. And those tracking the Millennium Development Goals says we are on track. We're doing a good job at working for access to safe drinking water. Now, to assess this, they're defining safe water as water from an improved source. So what does this mean? What does the phrase water from an improved source mean? Well, the World Health Organization describes improved source as a household connection or a public standpipe, a borehole, a protected dug well, a protected spring, a rainwater collection. So if that's where it's coming from, we're going to call that improved, which means then we're going to call it safe, I suppose. Not improved would be an unprotected well or an unprotected spring. Bottled water in many places is not safe, as are tanker trucks. So here's a picture of some improved water. This is an improved water supply in Karachi, Pakistan, in squatter settlements. They've taken a pump here and dug into the borehole, and they've got a rubber pipe on it so that when they do turn on the water for a couple hours, they can also turn on their pump and draw it at even higher pressure and pull even more of the stuff in from the surrounding area. If you take a look at that water and you bring it to the lab and you grow it, you grow out over 10,000 colony-forming units of organisms whose only natural environment is the mammalian intestine. And this is a community where diarrhea is the leading cause of death, and you're seeing 39 deaths per 1,000 live births. But according to the UN, this is improved water, and we're making progress. So I want to suggest a different definition of safe water. I want to say that safe water is a water without adverse health impacts, so that it should not have microbiological contamination. There shouldn't be bacteria, there shouldn't be viruses, there shouldn't be parasites. We should consider geological contamination. Drinking arsenic meets the Millennium Development Goals and the World Health Organization standards for safe water. And I think that is inappropriate. We also need to worry about industrial contamination. We heard a talk earlier today about the potential heavy metal contamination in the copper growing areas or the former copper mines of Zambia. In low-income countries, 90% of public waste is wastewater, and 70% of industrial waste is discharged directly onto the into surface water without treatment. So this is another aspect of the water problem that, with population density, further creates difficulties. And I also want to even step out of the purely human construct, and let's think about where we are in the world, and the ecological needs for water. These data are based on satellite maps of the world. Between 1993 and 2007, there was a 6% total decline in surface fresh water. And the areas of greatest decline are marked there in the dark blue, and you can see they are the areas of greatest population. So even in even during a time frame as short as 15 years, we're seeing a marked reduction in total surface water area available. Kind of reminds us of the New Zealand slide saying, wait a minute, we have more plans for fresh water than we have fresh water available. If we use all of the water only to feed people, and only to feed our animals, and only to feed agriculture, then it means we do not have wetlands. And wetlands perform important ecosystem services. They provision us with food, water, fiber, and fuel. They give us climate regulation, and also help to regulate water quality and disease. My image of New Zealand is a place of recreation, spiritual and aesthetic beauty too, and it's also very supporting for primary production and soil formation. So, if we look over the course in the 20th century, we have lost half of the world's wetlands. So, as we think going forward, how are we going to manage the decreasing per capita water supply? And we're thinking about how do we do this in a way that's healthy for people? We should also remember that we live and depend on the biosphere, and it too needs water. It too needs to be an important part of the plan. So we have an opportunity to continue to follow the business as usual approach. The business-as-usual approach is, with this growing demand, let's keep pushing exploitation promptly or at least progressively deplete groundwater aquifers. Expect that we will face food shortages. In bad years, we would expect to see famine and riots and political instability. And also, if we continue on this path of habitat destruction, expect irreversible damage to the biosphere. That's been the operational plan to date, and we can continue to go down that path. Alternatively, we can think broadly about other futures and how we might get there. And there's been an exercise in terms of world water vision to try to develop a widely shared view of how to bring about sustainable use and development of water resources globally. Each country, each water basin needs to address this on its own, but we also need to think about this globally. And this group has done a particularly good job of bringing in 15,000 stakeholders and using a participatory approach and trying to look at this across countries and river basins. And they see several critical issues to an alternative future. First, they argue that we need to limit the expansion of irrigated agriculture. The way that we have met the demands for a growing population has been to put more and more land under irrigation. but looking at declining water supplies and declining aquifers, we simply do not have the water supply to continue to meet these needs by continuing to expand irrigation. There needs to be a focus on increasing water productivity or getting more crop per drop. And the advantage of having more efficiency here is that if we can grow more by using drip irrigation or other techniques, you can get by with less infrastructure and less competition for water and actually have more water that you can use for other purposes. And there's also, they also urge an aggressive scientific focus on biotechnology writ large, thinking about how can we do this more efficiently, just as the Green Revolution in the 1970s really changed the issue of food availability. Can we think about doing, about making innovative breakthroughs here around the use of water and food? They also talk about increased storage, and most of the time when we think about increasing water storage, is, oh, we're going to build a dam. Well, I mean, dams do allow you to store water, but you actually lose a lot of water from evaporation from dams, and they also can be quite damaging to the environment. Some of the other ways that have been looked at are even issues of managed aquifer recharge. So we've talked about aquifers falling, and we can wait for them to recharge, or sometimes we can artificially recharge them. So in places that have monsoons, like in Bangladesh, one of the things we're looking at in areas where we have saline intrusion is during the rainy season, can we actually infiltrate the aquifers with more fresh water? The fresh water's lighter than the brackish water, and so have water storage during the dry season. There also needs to be consideration to reforming water resource management institutions. This is difficult because water crosses borders. River basins don't recognize political boundaries. And it's really at the level of the river basin that surface water needs to be managed. I know we have many economists in the group, and there needs to be, there needs to be payment for services and accountability of managers. We need to get some efficiency there, but at the same time, broader institutions need to play a role to ensure that that distributive justice and the needs of poor communities are met. And finally, they've called for increasing cooperation in international basins, valuing ecosystem functions. And I think we need to think about this as valuing not only in saying, oh yeah, this matters to me, or oh no, it's nice to have a few waterfalls, but how do we figure out with these very difficult competing demands about how to get enough water into our ecosystems and how do we create then environments to support innovation? So I want to echo some of the comments that were made when the conference was opened about the central importance of universities in facing the global water crisis. Historically, really, there's been an underinvestment in research on water in low-income settings, and there are a lot of very basic questions that are incompletely answered. Most aid agencies that give money to help water really have, or poor countries really have, rather weak assessments. And there's very limited, I want to focus particularly on social science support, like the idea of what's going on with the water anthropology in rural areas and how do people decide whether they're going to irrigate or not. And this is not a particularly fashionable question for anthropologists and anthropology students coming of age, but are areas that are real practical importance in terms of how are we going to get institutions that will manage these difficult problems, and would argue very consistent with this conference that we need a broad array of disciplines. I do think physicians have something to add, or civil engineers have a lot to add, but we need hydrogeologists, we need economists, we need anthropologists, and universities are really a place that can convene this kind of discussion and can excite young people about engaging on these issues of import. And this not only can help the students work to develop solutions, we can also have a more informed electorate who can help guide our leaders into making some of these tough choices. So what are the kinds of research questions that I would like to see taken on in universities? Some of the things around demand might be, what alternative pricing approaches can we make so that we can have water provided in a way that more closely matches global cost? If it doesn't, if you say, no, it's just free, we can do whatever we want with it, this might lead to misallocation. Are there ways, for example, that we might want to tax water-intense products and use some of that revenue for other contributions? Are agricultural subsidies for biofuels really a pathway to sustainability, when we're not just thinking about energy sustainability, but thinking about sustainability around water and around global populations? A real issue is how, with all of these human demands for human survival, do we value water to support wetland biodiversity? Can we imagine developing and implementing waste management strategies so that we don't use water just as a transportation vehicle for feces? Are there other ways that we might re-envision how we manage our excrement so that it's not so demanding of so much water? Are there ways we might be able to improve efficiency? Crops that can thrive on less water. It's striking to me that 25% of municipal water is lost in leaks. And I guess that, you know, having a PhD in pipe leaking is not something that Otago currently offers. And of course, our pipes were built in cities hundreds of years ago, I mean, or 100 or so years ago. But I just wonder, are there ways that we could deliver water that doesn't leak so much, and that we could detect and prepare leak and repair leaks without having to tear up all of the roads? How do we ensure drinking water quality in intermittently supplied systems? The idea that, wait a minute, we just need those countries to get a little wealthier and then they won't be able, and then they won't have to have intermittent supply. I don't think so, because per capita water availability is dropping, and low supply is going to be get worse, not better. And so thinking about, well, given that, are there ways we can make intermittent supply not quite so contaminated? Can we think about water recharging our aquifers more efficiently? And how do we really successfully govern the use of this shared resource? So the economists do a lot of work about common pool resources and escaping the prisoner's dilemma of always exploiting now rather than making decisions that are going to be more beneficial in the long term. So how can we apply some of these insights around water? So I would say in conclusion that the global water crisis really threatens humanity. It threatens our health, and it threatens the entire biosphere. It is a complex problem. This is not an easy problem. There's not a silver bullet. There's not one thing I'm going to tell you, well, this, if we just did manage aquifer recharge, this would all go away. No, I mean, all of these depends on the hydrogeology, depends on what you can do in those settings. And when we have these complex problems, we need interdisciplinary approaches to work to solve them. We also need to make sacrifices. And I can say, coming from an election-soaked country, sacrifices are not something that that come easy to high-income countries. But we're not going to be able to do everything just by squeezing more efficiency out. We're going to have to make some choices, and we're going to have to make some sacrifices. We also need some creativity. We need to be putting some of our bright young minds and get them excited about working on this. Because it's a steady problem that year by year, per capita water supply is going down and down. The sooner that we can work on this, the more latitude that we have for solutions. If we just continue a business as usual approach, we will get painted into a corner. So thank you very much for your attention.
So I'd like